Hi there, and welcome to Your Health Podcast. I'm Scott Hensley, head honcho for NPR's health blog, Shots.
And I'm Eliza Barkley. I also work on the blog and do just about everything else on NPR's science desk. We're sitting in for April Fulton and Rebecca Davis, since they are working on a story for Monday's Morning Edition. The premise of their story is that even at meals you might really remember, like when you got engaged, say, or had an amazing talk with somebody, often you'll remember much about the meal except for the food. One chef has teamed up with a memory expert to try to create meals where you actually remember exactly what you ate. That's their story, so be sure to catch it Monday.
Now, back to this week's stories. We're going to hear about the amount of calcium women should be taking after menopause, as well as a piece about hypertension in young adults.
There's an increase in complications related to prostate biopsies, and we've also got some advice on how to stay safe in a tornado.
But first, let's get started with prostate biopsies. Well over a million U.S. men get them each year. For most, the test isn't fun, but it's not dangerous. However, doctors are worried about an increasing number of complications that can be sudden and life-threatening. Richard Knox has our story.
Like lots of other guys, Tom Hayward's doctor urged him to have a prostate biopsy after a blood test indicated he might have cancer. It's called a PSA test. The biopsy involved firing tiny needles into the prostate gland to get tissue samples. The actual procedure wasn't as bad as Hayward expected.
It went fine. You know, it's not the most pleasant procedure in town, but it's not that uncomfortable, and it didn't take that long.
Next morning, he played tennis, had a full day of meetings, and at 5 he got into his car and headed off to a dinner engagement.
And from that point forward for about for an hour, I can't tell you, you know, how I got where I did, except I was on one of the three of the busiest expressways in Chicago.
When he didn't show up for the dinner, his wife got worried. Police located his car because it had an onboard navigation system. By that point, Hayward realized he was way off course.
15 minutes later, one of my sons, who's a lawyer here in town, pulled me over and said, "Give me the keys," and called an ambulance and took me to a local hospital.
His doctor, Anthony Schaefer, says a high fever had put Hayward into a mental fog. Hayward's problem? A raging infection.
It can happen very quickly. It's a very sudden and dramatic change in their status.
Hayward's infection was caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria that were present in his gut before the biopsy. The biopsy had introduced these bugs into his bloodstream. Doctors are usually able to cure these infections, but often men require hospital-intensive care and weeks of heavy-duty antibiotics. Now, post-biopsy infections like these are not common, but they're more common than they were a few years ago. That's according to Dr. Robert Nam at the University of Toronto. He did a study of how often Ontario men suffer serious infections after prostate biopsies.
It went from 1% to 4%.
That's a small number, but a huge increase.
A fourfold increase over a 10-year period in hospital admission rates for a diagnostic procedure, I think, is high, very high, concerningly high.
It's happening in the U.S., too. Johns Hopkins researchers did a big study of Medicare patients and found a sharp increase in serious infections. At last week's annual meeting of the American Urological Association, there were no fewer than 10 reports on the subject. One involved Anthony Schaefer, Tom Hayward's doctor. His focus is on preventing these infections. Schaefer and his colleagues at Northwestern University say they've been able to cut infections to zero by checking before a biopsy to see if a man harbors antibiotic-resistant bacteria. If he does, they give him antibiotics they know will knock out the resistant bugs.
The point is that this directive preventive therapy is designed to kill the bugs that are there versus just guessing as to what bugs might be there.
His colleague Robert Nadler says the infection risk is causing a lot of soul-searching about prostate biopsies.
I think this is forcing urologists to really step back and take a look to say, does this patient really need a biopsy? And I think that's what's happening.
By the way, you might be wondering whether Tom Hayward's biopsy discovered cancer.
The good news is the biopsies were negative. The bad news is the end result almost put me in the ground.
A high-priced test.
You're absolutely right. It's a high-priced test.
But if the doctor said, "Tom, you need another biopsy," he'd have one. Richard Knox, NPR News.
So Dick was also posting on the blog this week one about doctor behavior. Scott, oh, blog head honcho, can you tell us about that?
Yes, I can. It was an intriguing survey of doctors across the country that found more than 2 in 3 of U.S. doctors had said they had seen their colleagues, other doctors, disrupting patient care or interfering with collegial relationships at least once in the past month. And 1 in 10 said they saw it every day. So it was kind of a surprising finding, and the work that had been commissioned by the American College of Physician Executives was kind of a wake-up call, at least in the words of the executive, the head honcho of that group, who said that doctors really ought to look at themselves and try and be more professional, because there were effects on the way that patients got care and also in the way hospitals and offices run.
So, Scott, how many doctors are we talking about here?
Well, it was all kinds of doctors, surgeons, and other specialties. There were more than 800 who answered the survey, but it is important to note, as Dick did in his post, that they had to ask nearly 10,000 doctors to take the survey to get the 800 or so who actually did it. So is it completely representative? Unclear, but the findings are provocative and enough for the group that helped commission it to say, let's do something about it.
That is pretty interesting. I also saw something about a MacBook.
Yes, I thought this was very intriguing. A clever bunch of researchers, including a guy who's pursuing a PhD in bioinformatics out at Stanford, were looking for a way to find weird, unexpected drug side effects. So most people who have a prescription get that long list of things, be careful about this or that. But if you take more than one drug, some combination, there can be unexpected side effects. Some of them are known, but many are not. And what this guy did was pore over more than 13,000 drug adverse event reports from the FDA, trying to find some unusual side effects related to diabetes, and they found one that really stood out, and it was a combination of the cholesterol-fighting drug Pravacol and the antidepressant Paxil. And in patients who were taking both of those, there was a significant increase in blood sugar. Now, the paper cautioned that this was the exact clinical significance of this was unknown so far, but they felt that it showed that their technique worked and that there is further study needed to figure out what's going on here in the case of Pravacol and Pravastatin.
But you mentioned something about a MacBook, didn't you?
Indeed. I was curious to know, well, to do this kind of research, do you have to have some kind of supercomputer? So I asked the guy, well, what did you use to crunch all those different adverse event forms? And it turned out it was just the guy's MacBook Pro. Did it take a long time? I asked him. He said, no, it was just a few minutes. So that was another reason why he thought that this technique looks like it would work, and it doesn't require any special hardware. The real trick was the algorithm that they used, which learned as it went how to find the things in the database.
Those MacBooks, they sure are powerful. Lastly, wanted to ask you about measles. What are we hearing about measles?
We've had quite a bit about measles and other outbreaks of infectious disease on shots lately, but I have to say I was surprised to learn that the U.S. is on track to have the most measles cases in 15 years already this year. And the intriguing part of it is that most of those cases, nearly 90%, are imports. It's people who are going overseas and picking up measles in places where it's still being transmitted from person to person.
How does this outbreak of measles in the United States compare to other countries around the world?
It's small. The problem is that measles is not as well controlled in many places that Americans are visiting. So, for instance, France this year has had something like 10,000 cases of measles, and it is the leading source of these imported cases. India was another one that had a lot. So what we've been able to do so far in the U.S. is keep measles under control by having such a high level of vaccination, and that is not the case in many other countries.
What does the CDC do when these measles cases pop up in the United States?
The CDC and local health departments are incredibly aggressive about trying to find all the people who might have been around, the people who got measles, and making sure that they got vaccinated. And I would refer folks who are listening to the podcast, as I did in the post, to a great item that you did, actually, about this guy, a grad student flying back from Germany, who had the misfortune of sitting near somebody on the plane who was later found to have measles, and the health department in Wisconsin, where he lived, dogged him until he was able to show that, in fact, he had been immunized. So get your vaccination and make sure that you keep those records just in case.
Indeed. Poor Matt Colstead had to call up his mom and ask for his vaccination records. So have those on file. That's Matt's lesson. Well, thank you so much, Scott.
You bet.
We now go on to research Patty Naiman reported this week on hypertension among young adults.
Sociologist Kathleen Mullen-Harris is analyzing a number of health surveys that were mandated by Congress in the mid-90s. The idea was to examine the health and habits of teenagers. Those teens are now young adults between 24 and 32, and many of them don't even know they have high blood pressure.
It's asymptomatic. You know, there aren't any outward symptoms. People don't feel any different, even though they have high blood pressure.
In the latest analysis, Mullen-Harris found the rate of high blood pressure among young adults alarming.
Nearly one in five, or 19%, of young adults had high blood pressure.
High blood pressure is risky enough when you are middle-aged. But when it starts young, in your 20s or even younger, it can set into play a series of dangerous consequences. Dr. Stephen Hirschfeld is an official with the National Institutes of Health and a pediatrician.
Blood pressure causes changes in the structure of the body, and those changes in the structure of the body are generally irreversible, and they compromise the function of many organs and many systems,
which makes the body more vulnerable to sudden problems like ruptured blood vessels, blood clots, and internal bleeding, and diseases like diabetes and heart disease. The researchers say while the findings are disturbing, they're not exactly surprising. The majority of young adults surveyed were either overweight or obese, which is known to cause high blood pressure. Sociologist Mullen-Harris.
In 1995, 11% of the sample was obese. When we followed them up 5 to 6 years later, that doubled. And then we followed them up 5 to 6 years later, 37% are obese.
And many of them were simply overweight. Overall, 67% were overweight or obese. That pretty much reflects national trends among all U.S. adults. Now, it's important to note this isn't the first study of high blood pressure among the 24 to 32-year-old age group. Other federal surveys have found hypertension, but at far lower rates. So researchers and federal health officials agree more study of young adults in particular is needed to figure out exactly how big a problem this is. But Dr. Hirschfeld says any hypertension is a problem and should be prevented.
Everyone should have checkups and have their weight, their blood pressure, their blood sugar, and other measures of their general health checked regularly, no matter how old they are.
Part of the problem is that your typical 20-something may not visit the doctor on a routine basis or even monitor their blood pressure. Hirschfeld says that should change, especially if they're overweight. And steps could be taken to make it easier to check up on your own health. Organizations could follow the lead of pharmacies, for example, by installing free blood pressure checks at airports, supermarkets, or shopping malls in much the same way flu shots are readily available nationwide. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
Next up, we've got some more news for postmenopausal women who get all kinds of advice thrown at them all the time, it seems. Women have been told that they need more calcium to reduce their risk of osteoporosis and hip fractures. But Nancy Shute reports on a new study that says taking any more than 750 milligrams a day may not be beneficial.
It makes sense that women over 50 should be doing everything they can to avoid osteoporosis. It increases the risk of hip fractures, which kill 16,000 people a year and cripple many more. But taking lots of calcium doesn't look like it's much help. A big new study in the British Medical Journal found no benefit from consuming more than 750 milligrams a day. Eva Vornshow is an epidemiologist at Uppsala University in Sweden. She is the lead author on that study, which followed 61,000 women.
We didn't find, as you would think, the higher intake of calcium, the lower the risk of fractures and osteoporosis.
But that's not a huge surprise. Doctors in the United States have been saying pretty much the same thing for years. Harvard researcher Joanne Manson is a principal investigator in the Women's Health Initiative.
More is not necessarily better, and moderate intake may be optimal. There may be a threshold effect where once you get to a moderate level of intake, there's no further benefit.
In fact, taking more calcium could be not just worthless, it could cause other health problems such as
kidney stones and possibly an increased risk of cardiovascular diseases found in some recent studies.
Last year, the Institute of Medicine said that women over 50 should aim for 1,200 milligrams a day, whether or not they have signs of bone loss. That is higher than the amount recommended in Sweden and other European countries. Manson helped write that report, and she's not ready to say that number is too high. Still, that doesn't mean that all women need supplements.
This does not mean that women need to take calcium supplements containing 1,200 milligrams a day, because on average, close to 700 milligrams a day would come from diet.
So, most American women are getting as much as the Swedish study recommended without taking any calcium supplements. But many people haven't gotten that message. John Tung is an orthopedic surgeon in Portland, Oregon. He's been operating on women with hip fractures caused by osteoporosis for more than 30 years. So when this new study came out, he asked his wife how many calcium supplements she's taking.
I interviewed my wife last night and found out that she's taking more than the recommended dose in the United States.
How much more?
She's taking 1,400 milligrams. As a supplement in addition to whatever calcium she has in a normal diet.
That's getting up there. But she's also exercising, which Tung thinks is more important than calcium for keeping bones strong.
A brisk walk for 20 to 40 minutes a day would do much more to improve people's general health and reduce their risk of injury than taking more vitamins or other supplements, which are so common.
But all too often, he says, his patients look for the answer, not in common sense prescriptions like that, but in supplements that come in a jar. Nancy Shute, NPR News.
We're going to end with some advice on staying as safe as possible during a tornado. As we all know, it's been a particularly rough season with bad tornadoes hitting populated areas. NPR's John Hamilton took a look at the best ways to take shelter.
People who study tornadoes tend to have a detailed plan for surviving one. Harold Brooks is a researcher at the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma.
The walk-in closet on our master bedroom suite is 6 inches of reinforced concrete with a steel door on it and a 6-inch cap on top of the closet, and we can get in there with children, pets, valuables, and things like that.
Brooks says a shelter like that protects you from things like a 2x4 ripped from a wall and propelled by winds that can exceed 200 miles an hour.
It's like getting hit by a baseball bat. Bricks that fly through the air are also causes of major injuries, and so it's all of those things as structures start to fall apart and produce lots of 6-inch to 2-foot long missiles that can hit you or impale you, and that's pretty much how people get hurt.
Brooks says people who don't have a shelter can still do a lot to protect themselves.
Get low, put walls between you and a small room if possible, a closet, an interior bathroom, a small hallway. Once you get in there, something like a bicycle helmet or a football helmet on your head, and that can help dramatically improve your chances of surviving without significant injury.
But a lot of people don't do any of that. Instead, they do things like opening all the windows, thinking it will prevent their house from exploding in the low-pressure eye of a tornado. Brooks says that's a myth, and open windows can cause another problem.
Because once the wind gets inside of your house, it essentially can start to lift the roof up off the house.
People in cars make mistakes, too. Robin Tanamachi is a researcher at the Center for Analysis and Prediction of Storms in Norman. She spent the past 8 years chasing severe storms in radar trucks.
One thing that we've observed quite frequently is that people will try to shelter under highway overpasses, and that's a tremendously bad idea.
It's also become very popular, thanks to a video from 1991 that shows a news crew hiding under an overpass as a tornado goes by. That strategy doesn't usually work. Since then, several people who've tried it have died. And research shows that an overpass can act like a wind tunnel and actually make you more vulnerable. The best thing to do if you're in a car is drive to a building. Fast food restaurants are good because they usually have a walk-in cooler that will work as a shelter. Tanimachi says driving away from a tornado can also save your life, but you shouldn't try to outrun the twister, as many people do. Instead, pick an escape route that takes you 90 degrees from the storm's path. And Tanimachi says drivers need to plan for the worst.
If you find yourself in a vehicle and unable to escape from the tornado, abandon the vehicle and try to get into a nearby ditch or a culvert. Protect your head and face, and don't look at the tornado as it goes by, because you may be impacted by debris.
For scientists like Tanimachi, these safety steps aren't just theoretical. After all, she lives in Norman, Oklahoma, which is in the area known as Tornado Alley. On Tuesday evening, Tanimachi was taking part in a workshop at the National Weather Center in Norman when the twisters appeared.
They actually did issue a tornado warning that affected our building, and we all had to evacuate down into the tornado shelter for a while.
Until the tornado subsided a few miles away. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And that's it for the podcast. Thanks so much for listening this week. Coming up on the radio side, there's April's food memory story on Monday. Also, All Things Considered has Elise Spiegel's two-parter on a controversial psychological test that decides who is a psychopath and who is not.
Also, look for Elise's piece on the web. And next week, on the blog, we'll have exclusive results from an NPR Thomson Reuters poll about Americans' feelings about abortion. Have a great Memorial Day.